and even more extremely motivated to rise high in the world. Johns Hopkins and MIT honed his intelligence and his diplomatic skills. At school, he was quickly dubbed Omar the Tent Maker. Instead of becoming angry at the derogatory nickname, Rashid turned it into a badge of honor. His career with Masterson Aerospace had been little short of meteoric. As head of the Space Operations Division, he knew that the corporate knives were being sharpened behind his back. Space Operations was the corporation's largest division, thanks to the Clipper ships, a profitable cash cow that various reorganization plans sought to carve up into smaller sections and remove from Rashid's control. He resisted those attempts with a mixture of deft corporate maneuvering and unfailing loyalty from his division staff. He also used his urbane charm wherever it would do the most good, especially with the chairwoman of the board. Joanna enjoyed his attentions, as she did those of Carlos Quintana and several others. It amused her to watch the male ego at work and to manipulate their testosterone-driven ambitions toward goals of her own choosing. Rashid stepped into Joanna's office and looked around appreciatively. He was short and compact in build, rather like Paul, thought Joanna, although slimmer. A trim black beard framing his oval face, Rashid had movie star looks, huge, soulful dark brown eyes, and a smile to die for. He was smiling now as he sat in the delicate little love seat facing Joanna's personal chair. "Desert golds and tans," he said, noticing the decor. "And a scent of jasmine. Are you trying to make me homesick?" Joanna laughed. "For Baltimore?" "Racial memory," Rashid bantered. "Jung claimed that we all have primitive memories stored in our subconscious minds." "Maybe my ancestry goes back to the desert," Joanna said. "I like this color scheme, and I love the Southwest. Arabs prefer cities. My people are great architects." Joanna decided they had chatted enough. Time to get down to business. "Omar, how would you feel if I suggested that my son Greg be the next director of Moonbase?" Rashid did not seem surprised. He eased one arm across the back of the loft seat and crossed his legs. "O'Rourke is slated for that position." "I know, but..." She let the sentence dangle. "O'Rourke is very competent." "Unimaginative, true, but very competent." "I asked Ginny if she'd stay on until the polar expedition came back, and she refused," Joanna said. The slightest of ticks twitched at the corner of Rashid's mouth. "You should have spoken to me first. I would have told you she'd refuse. She's going to be married." His voice was soft, yet Joanna heard his disapproval. She had gone over his head to speak directly to Anson. "My other son's out at the South Pole with Brennard." "Yes, I am aware of that." "I don't like the idea of changing base directors while the expedition's out there." Rashid shrugged elaborately. "It really makes almost no difference whatsoever. The base director is in no position to help or harm the expedition."
"Really?"
"The expedition is rather self-sufficient. Brennard knows what he's doing."
"Even with one of the cargo ships crashed?"
Again the shrug. "They'll resupply earlier than scheduled. It's not a major problem."
"So you don't think Anson's leaving will be a problem?"
"Of course not. If I did, she wouldn't be leaving, believe me." Joanna studied his handsome face. Rashid seemed completely at ease, totally confident.
"Then, allowing Greg to take over..."
He spread his hands. "It shouldn't be a problem. O'Rourke has more experience, but your son has shown quite remarkable leadership qualities." Almost, Joanna blurted her fear that Greg still hated his younger half-brother. "You're being irrational," Joanna told herself sternly. Yet the fear was still there, gnawing inside her.
"This must be a very difficult decision for you," Rashid said softly, smiling at her from an arm's length away.
Joanna's thoughts snapped back to the here and now.
"No," she said. "No, it isn't difficult at all. Unless you are actively opposed, Greg Masterson will replace Ginny Anson as the director of Moonbase."
"Effective on the first of the month?" Rashid asked.
"Yes, but I want Greg to get up there right away and spend Ginny's final days at Moonbase getting oriented."
"How soon?"
"Today,"
Joanna snapped. Rashid dipped his head slightly. "Hearkening and obedience."
Moonbase. Ginny Anson felt her teeth grinding together as she looked over the graph on her desktop screen. Solar flare, she said almost accusingly. The technician who had been monitoring the astronomical instruments in Bianca Ree's absence nodded unhappily. And it's going to be a big mother, is it?
Class 4 flare, maybe a 5.
Anson leaned back in her creaking plastic chair and glared at the young tech.
How soon? She snapped.
The technician was barely into his 20s, still an undergraduate student who had taken a year off to make money by working at Moonbase. Standing in front of Anson's desk in his baggy frayed coveralls, he shuffled his feet uncertainly.
Hard to say, he replied. I've checked with Tucson. Next 24 hours for sure. Could be a lot sooner, though.
Great. I'll have to alert the surface crews.
And, Brennart's people?
Yes, them too. They should have their shelters dug in by now. Will the radiation hit them? The young man looked miserably unsure of himself.
Hard to say, he repeated.
Oh, they'll get the first pulse, sure enough. The ultraviolet and X-rays.
But the heavy stuff, that depends on how the interplanetary magnetic fields twist it up.
Rankled, Anson said,
So you don't know when the particle cloud will hit or how heavy it'll be?
Nobody could tell you that, the kid said defensively. Not this far in advance.
Okay.
Anson squinted at his name tag.
Albertson. Thanks for the bad news.
The kid fled her office as if afraid for his life. A class 4 solar flare, she thought. Maybe a 5. Just what we need. Angrily, she punched her keyboard to call up the communications center. Got to get all the surface workers inside and warn Brennart's people. As she spoke to the comm center, Anson pictured in her mind what they were going to be facing. The most violent event the solar system can produce. An explosion on the sun with the force of 100 billion megatons of TNT. More energy than the whole world consumes in 50,000 years. Hardly a quarter second's worth of the sun's total energy output, but enough to kill anyone caught in its lethal plasma cloud. Enough to wreck unprotected equipment.
What about cislunar traffic? The comm technician asked.
What's it look like? Anson asked back. The tech's face disappeared from her desktop screen, and a visual display of the Earth-Moon traffic showed 4 green arrows representing unmanned freighters heading for the factories in Earth orbit, and a single violet arrow of a passenger vehicle on its way to the Euro-Russian base at Grimaldi. There were 3 yellow arrows as well, Yamagata spacecraft, 2 inbound, 1 heading earthward. As she watched, Anson saw a new red arrow appear on the screen. A passenger-carrying craft was leaving Earth orbit, heading for Moonbase.
What's that new blip? She asked. I don't recall anything scheduled today.
The technician's voice answered,
Message just came in. It's in your voicemail. Your replacement is on his way.
O'Rourke's coming now? Anson felt puzzled, annoyed.
It's not O'Rourke, the tech's voice replied. It's Gregory Masterson III.
The technician pronounced the name with appropriate awe in her voice.
Shit on a shingle, Anson exploded. Get that poor dumb boob on a horn and tell him to abort his flight and get his butt back home where it's safe. That's all I need, having the boss's son fried.
It's ice all right, but I'm afraid it's pretty thin, said Roger Deems. He, Brennart, Killifer, and Doug Stavanger were jammed into the analysis lab of the expedition's main shelter. Deems was still in his cumbersome spacesuit, minus only its helmet, which made the little cubicle even more crowded. The only light came from one of the computer screens. Doug could hear the grating patter of regolith rubble being piled on the shelter's curving roof. Outside, the expedition's mini-tractors were struggling to dig up enough surface dirt to provide the necessary coverage for radiation protection and thermal insulation. The regolith here in the South Polar Highlands was thin and hard, its normally powder-like texture vacuum-welded into the consistency of concrete. The remotely operated little tractors were having a hard time digging up enough of it to cover the expedition's 4 shelters. Brennart had to send people out to jury-rig some of their aluminum and oxygen rocket propellants to burn into the hard rock and break it into manageable chunks.
"We should have brought a couple tons of plastic explosives," one of the tractor operators grumbled.
Deems's job, immediately upon landing, had been to lead a team to the ice field that the unmanned probes had identified.